Welcome to WJR's Internet Advisor Podcast. Catch the live show weekends on News Talk 760 WJR and online at internetadvisor.net. Now, here are your hosts.
Welcome to the Internet Advisor, your place for answers to your computer questions since 1998, with your co-hosts Gary Baker and Foster Brown and their team of tech experts. The door is always open at internetadvisor.net, on Facebook, and through Twitter. But right now it's time to get you in touch with your helpful hosts on this week's edition of Internet Advisor.
Welcome aboard the Internet Advisor. Hi, Foster Brown. Glad to be back with you. Sitting in the saddle here, we've got a whole team in the studio, and we have got a fascinating topic. We're going to be talking about cyber warfare today, and this exploded on the headlines recently. We have an expert in studio with us, and we're also going to be talking with one of the former directors of the CIA and some of our top nation's security about this as well. A big program coming up today on the Internet Advisor. Don't miss a minute of it. Welcome to the Internet Advisor once again. Hi, this is Foster Brown with you. Glad to be with you for another program, and it's a very special one. I have to say that it almost kind of fell into our laps, and we'll explain that in just a moment. But first, our team members, Gary Baker, good to have you here.
It's great to be back. I was up on the island and at our annual conference for Society for Manufacturing Engineers, so I missed last week, and now I'm back.
See, he was taking an island vacation.
It wasn't much of a vacation, but lots of work, lots of fun, as many people that were there know.
So. Yeah, exactly. Ed Riddell, good to have you in-house again.
I was mowing the lawn. It's always great to be here, Foster.
And I know where Cal was last week. Cal, you did a great job, by the way, co-hosting the program. Thank you very much. Uneasy lies the crown now. Thank you very much,
and,
Cal.
No.
And if anybody wants to hear it, you can sign up in iTunes and our podcast every time. Yep. And last week was a special one.
Cal, it was very, very
Cal just stepped in ably.
There's no way in the world I could take full credit for that interesting experience. I got to say that both Ed Riddell was a great coach, and so was Shane Hamlin, the two guys. You know, we worked together as a team to make sure that this thing works.
Ed just always makes everybody here look good, so that's wonderful.
Thank you, Ed. Now, guys, what we want to do is get right into our topic today, and that means introducing the person who is with us in studio. Very graciously, we had arranged to have him in studio, or he had agreed to be with us here, is Richard Steenan is with us. And Gary, why don't you give the official credits so we can welcome him informally.
Well, Richard has been with us a number of times. He and I first met. We were competitors. You had RustNet, Richard, and I had Online Technologies. Very, very early days of the Internet.
Almost 20 years ago.
Don't say that. We were young kids, very young kids at that time. But you went off PwC. You went off on really took off on security, and that was really you became just an expert at security. And Gartner, worked at Gartner, and then now and a number of other little places, or not little places, but a number of other places for shorter times to do special things. And now at IT Harvest, welcome Richard Steenan.
Thank you very much, Gary Foster. Good to be back.
And we should mention also, we've had you on before to talk about Mike Brennan, and you co-authored a book called Cyber Stiletto.
Right.
Yep. And it kind of talked about some of the things that we're going to be figuring around today.
Your own book.
Right.
That's right.
So
Cyber warfare book.
Right. And really, that was kind of your coming out really to understand this whole area of cyber warfare. And it's different. It's certainly part of security, but it really has very different complexion than the typical kid in their basement trying to hack into, you know, this, that, or the other thing, or
phone
steal
companies.
Credit cards or whatever. Yeah. I mean,
and
this,
from the
this
defenders,
is big, big, scary stuff.
You bet. From the defender standpoint, it's a little bit of Back to the Future, because way back in the mainframe days, you worried about targeted attacks, people after your stuff. And now we're coming back to that. We're not worried as much about the hackers.
The whole complexion of this thing, and part of what we want to have you help us to get our arms around, it just really fell out wonderfully that when we were having you come in here last week as we were doing our program, it had just begun to break the whole business about Stuxnet and allegations that appeared. And by the way, folks, if you go to internetadvisor.net, on our homepage, we have the article that was written called Allegations of Secret U.S. Cyber War Shake the World. And that was David Sanger's article that came out in the New York Times on June the 1st, I believe.
Yep.
That painted this picture of full-scale cyber war going on, something that you have been talking about for, but kind of taking the cover off of it and saying, hey, the United States, along with some other allies, is behind this massive thing that is not just malware, but these are things that are called, I understand, advanced persistent threats. In other words, they're bugs that go to stay. They're not just there to cause havoc. They're there to gather information as well as do other things.
Well, and we don't know for sure that the U.S. or Israel is behind it. They are allegations. However, if you go to our site, internetadvisor.net, you can link off to Sanger's article in the New York Times. And there's a lot of detail there, like what day they were in the Situation Room at the White House and who was there and what they said, and a lot of detail.
And pieces of a destroyed centrifuge. You know,
yeah, how do they cover that if that didn't happen, right?
Yeah. It's fascinating.
Of course, that's the way you write good fiction. You fill in details.
That's right? True. Yeah. And so Gary has done it well. He said it's allegations, but what's happened is in the past week, all these things have come out. Matter of fact, Ed and Cal, I believe that you guys talked about Stuxnet and Flame, which is another one of these massive advanced persistent threats that's out there now. So I guess, Rich, what we want to do, Rich, we want to try to find out, how do we get our arms around this to understand what's going on, this new class, it looks like, of warfare? But actually, this has been out there for quite a while. Sure. When did this all start? When did we seem to get into this?
Yeah, it came about slowly, but 2003 was when we saw the first public acknowledgement that something was going on. We called it Titan Rain. And that was when Sean Carpenter, sitting at his desk at Sandia Labs, discovers these servers that have documents from hundreds of U.S. research agencies sitting on them in China. And that was like the FBI was on to some of this at the same time. They started working with Sean and uncovered the spy ring that was going on. And still, that was just the beginning.
So we broke into computers in China and found out that they had already gotten our secret.
Well, Sean discovered the attack and was told not to go there, but he continued to do it from home. And thus ensued a whole story of his being fired for disobeying orders and a suit for wrongful discharge, which he ultimately won. Mm. But in the meantime, he's kind of been exonerated because he was at the forefront of it.
So it almost seems like there has been this huge thing that's been going on for quite a while, and everybody's kind of pretending, oh, no, shh, it's not there, Well, we're going to...
It must be science fiction, right?
There's been some great movie plots, Live or Die, something else, I forget, came up. That was a great one. But anyway, folks, we are going to be tackling this subject today with Richard Dean in studio. We're also going to be having a very special guest coming on with us as well, and that is retired General Michael V. Hayden, a former director of the CIA during much of this time. So please do stay tuned to the Internet Advisor for a great program. Don't want to miss a minute. Thank you for joining us once again for a great program I think we have in line for you today. Kind of an eye-opener, I think, for all of us. We're all in a little bit kind of shell-shocked by the release of information that has come out over the past 7 to 10 days. Allegations that on June the 1st by David Sanger in the New York Times that the United States, as a matter of fact, was behind the Stuxnet virus that was released. And quite an elaborate allegation there. Very expansive article. And we have with us in studio today, we're delighted again, Richard Steenan, who is a security expert and industry analyst. He's also been our guest here a number of times. And Richard, I thought what you'd help us, I'd like you to, if you could help us to get some sense of this whole different class of malware that's out there right now. And I've seen it kind of all pulled together under the umbrella of advanced persistent threat. Exactly what are those APTs and how have they changed the game?
Yeah, the most salient fixture or feature of APT is that it's targeted at a particular organization, even an individual. And the first phase of it is actually researching your target, finding out what network assets they have, what their Facebook page is, figure out what their cat's name is. And then eventually getting on that person's computer. And that could be through an email with an attachment to it. Mm-hmm. But the trick is, in most of these cases, the email apparently comes from somebody or somebody inside your organization.
Or they've been able to spoof a security certificate, for instance. Exactly. I heard about that today, Collision.
Yep. They'll spoof everything so you go, this has got to be for me, and I'm going to open this against all the advice of my IT department.
So if I don't have a nuclear reactor with centrifuges, I don't have to worry about Stuxnet?
If in this day and age, a lot of the APTs are involved in industrial and economic espionage. So if you have, not only if you are involved in oil and gas, either pipelines or resource discovery, Or you're some sort of manufacturer, and somebody in another country would want to get up to speed quickly by just stealing everything you have, then you're a target. And frankly, from everybody I talk to who's out there seeing this every day, just about everybody's becoming a target. And then even if you've got great security, your law firm's going to be the target because they've got all your documents for your patent applications, your contracts and negotiations. Yeah. There's two law firms in Toronto that were completely infiltrated, all their emails, documents taken, who were engaged in this big acquisition that was going on of a big oil and gas company in Canada, and China was the acquirer. And there's a lot of people trying to stop that deal from happening. China stole everything.
I got to go back. I got to go back to Stuxnet. Here's this nuclear reactor. It's inside a foreign country, one that we don't get access to very well. Right. It's not connected to the internet. How did somebody get Stuxnet into that environment?
Yeah, apparently they got the malware on somebody's computer that was outside.
Oh, awesome. Right.
So it gets onto a thumb drive, and then the thumb drive's used on the inside of the network, crossing this air gap, and then it gets infected. And the part that even Sanger's article doesn't tell us about is somehow it got the surveillance information out again.
Yes.
Which could have been through a thumb drive and just wait until somebody uses it on an outside computer. Or there could have been agents involved that had access to it.
So there's a human factor to this. This isn't all hocus pocus. In other words, that somebody might come in and steal my brain some night when I'm asleep. Well, that might happen. It's rather small. But essentially there is a human factor to this.
Yeah.
And the social engineering we talked about so often, Gary. We hate these wretched things that come and steal from us, but very often we're the ones who hand them the keys, unknowingly, albeit.
Just walk through a parking lot, scatter a bunch of USB drives all over the place.
You talked about a test that they did with that, Gary, one time.
Oh, yeah. We were our QSA that came in as our test for our security when I was at a company that I previously worked at. Well, they're out of business now, Borders. And basically, we knew they were coming in to do the test. And we said, put out a message to every employee that said, if you find a USB drive in the parking lot tonight or tomorrow morning, turn them in at the security desk. Do not plug them into your computer. And we got 11. And when the QSA showed up, we handed them 11, we said, this is the security. None of them reached the network, and that was true, but he had scattered 12. We don't know what happened to the other one, but it never hit our network.
It was under somebody's tire, perhaps.
It might have been.
Richard, what strikes...
And is that what happened? I mean, could that be the way they got it into the nuclear reactor?
It could be,
who knows?
But that would have been a little scattershot.
Yeah.
I suspect that either a agent, we know that several countries have agents embedded in Iran, so it could have been an agent.
Cal?
Okay, so now the magic question. Ordinary Joe Blow person, unless I'm affiliated with something that these people are trying to find, my chances of being invaded will probably be kind of low. Is that correct?
Yeah, because you won't be targeted.
Right.
Okay. However, if I think I'm going to be targeted, just like back in the old days when people didn't trust banks and they stuffed all their money into a mattress, where do you stuff your data at so it doesn't get touched?
First of all, it should be encrypted.
Okay.
And then the access to it, when you access it, it's got to ask for something for you to do. So type in your password.
And probably two-factor authentication, right? How would that work?
If it's top secret stuff. But if it's just your data and your private emails, as long as it's encrypted and you've got a good passphrase to get to the data, then the APT is not going to get it until it tricks you into opening that file.
Would it be safe to, as crazy as this may sound and it's Mission Impossible nuts as it is, have two different types of profiles in life? One that you do your financial and your business type transactions with and an entirely different profile for doing your personal stuff with.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people who do that.
Yeah, I would imagine, especially if you're handed with increased sensitivity of data. I imagine that would be a good solution. Let's talk a little bit about two other players that are out there. One in particular, I just heard it again today. Flame is another one of these APTs that's out there. Talk about that a little bit, because I understand, I just saw a news article before I came in here, that Symantec had a honeypot out there, a computer that allowed itself to get infected with this. They actually watched Flame erase itself and then write junk bits all over every place it was on. What was or is Flame?
Yeah, Flame is apparently a cyber espionage tool that once installed, does turn on your camera, records images, records audio, steals files, uploads them. So it's definitely doing the reconnaissance and surveillance for some sort of future attack. And because most of the infections are in Iran, the assumption is there that it's also targeted against Iran's weapons capability.
Am I right that they're also saying that it probably preceded Stuxnet? Because they've looked at this thing and said it's been out there for, I've heard sometimes, 4 to 5 years.
Yeah, yeah. So apparently it may have been the precursor to Stuxnet. It may have been the spy network that they used in order to get a map.
It did the reconnaissance.
Did the reconnaissance.
And in the about a mile and a half of code, right, is the amount of code that was in Flame when they tore it all apart and put it end to end, right? In that, they said they found some things that lead them to believe that some of that code came from 2007.
Right.
Of course, maybe that was a spoof, too, to throw off the trail. Right.
It's
right?
Circles
who knows?
Within circles.
Right? It is. So then, let's just talk about the mention. I'm sorry, was that Eddie? Go ahead.
What I was going to say is I thought it very interesting that it was Kapersky that actually discovered Flame, from my understanding, and that Kapersky actually
Which is a Russian security firm.
Certainly, right. And we've used Kapersky antivirus software
exactly.
in the firewall. Yeah. And they threw 43 antivirus programs at this, and none of them discovered it. And I think, it was another honeypot that actually, you know, was actually what discovered the virus.
Yeah, Kaspersky has taken the lead, especially in Dooku, and they found four different remnants of malware that look like they're related to Stuxnet, Dooku being one of them. They haven't made that connection to Flame yet. And then just Friday, a couple of researchers pointed out that Flame actually mimics the Microsoft Update service, which is one of the scariest things.
Yes.
2 years ago, I was at a conference in Dublin, and I asked an open question, you know, any help coming up with some great ideas for what a cyber weapon would look like. Mm-hmm. And a guy over dinner nudges me and he goes, Microsoft Update, where you can target which machine you want, tell it you've got an update for it, and either the machine automatically reboots and updates,
wow.
or it asks you to update, but you've checked the digital signature,
yep.
it looks like it came from a Microsoft server, and you say okay. And that's exactly what Flame does.
Wow. We are going to come back in just a moment and be speaking with our second guest, and thank you very much, by the way, Richard, for making this connection. Retired General Michael V. Hayden. He was in charge of the CIA from 2006 to 2009. Also the director of the National Security Agency from 1999 to 2005. We're going to be talking with him about some of the impact that these allegations about Stuxnet have or could have on the U.S. and its foreign policy in just a moment. Thank you very much for joining us here on the Internet Advisor, Foster Brown, and our team, along with Richard Steenan, who is a security expert. And we are delighted to be able to bring with us on our program today somebody who certainly is an expert in the field of our national security, that is retired General Michael V. Hayden, who was director of the CIA from 2006 to 2009, and also director of the National Security Agency before that from 1999 to 2005, and now is working for the private sector. General, thank you very much for joining us here on the Internet Advisor.
Well, Foster, thanks for the chance to be with you this afternoon.
We certainly called you up at the suggestion of Richard Steenan, who is here with us in the studio, because we're trying to kind of get our heads around this whole notion of what these advanced persistent threats are. And there was, of course, the headline bursting that happened with the New York Times article that had some pretty serious allegations about the U.S.'s involvement in that. What I'd like to ask you about, because obviously this is something that is classified to a certain extent in terms of the kind of things you can reveal.
Right.
What's the impact of that kind of an allegation being made on an international level?
Well, Foster, I'm glad you used the word allegation, and that, you know, gives me some freedom to kind of describe it without attempting to speculate who may or may not have caused
sure.
it. And the most important thing, and I've actually said this well before the New York Times stories came out, and that this is really something very, very big. I frankly believe that crashing 1,000 centrifuges in the Natanz is a really good idea. But we also have to recognize that it's a really big idea, too. I mean, you and your audience, your team there are familiar with, you know, what's been going on in the cyber domain. But frankly, this is the very first time on any major scale that we've actually used a cyber weapon, not for cyber effect, not for espionage, but to create physical destruction in what some other nation could only describe as their own critical infrastructure. I'm not a technologist, I'm
sure.
a historian, so I look for historical examples, and one that comes to mind immediately is somebody's crossed the Rubicon.
Yes.
We now we now have a legion on a different side of the river. Yeah. And the other thought, and this was actually reflected in one of the New York Times articles, is that I understand the destructive power is far different. But this just has the whiff of August 1945 about it. Someone has just used a new class of weapon.
Yes.
And things will never be the same again.
General, I'm glad you said that, because in this world of digital, the domain, anybody from a kid with acne in his basement to a boardroom full of experts can pull off some pretty incredible things. In other words, this isn't, you know, we've developed this new atom bomb, but the components for it, we don't have to enrich uranium for this. It's out there. It's ons and offs.
Well, in one way, I'm going to try to push back a little bit on what you're saying.
Okay.
And another way, Foster, I'm going to push with you, all right?
Okay.
Let me do the pushback first, all right? This thing, from what I've read about it in the paper, was incredibly complex and is not the kind of thing that anyone is going to do in their dad's garage or their mom's basement.
Right.
All right? This is nation-state stuff.
Okay.
All right? I got that. But what's happening is, you know, you look at the malevolent actors out there in the cyber domain. You've got nation states, you've got criminals, and then you've got hacktivists. And, and every time a nation state improves the art form, they raise the water level for everybody.
Yep.
And so these things that now, today, only nation states can do, in some period of time, then we're going to see these other actors who will be probably far less restrained and far less responsible.
Absolutely.
Using these tools. And let me make it even worse, all right? One of the reasons this was so incredibly complex, that when most nation states try to do something like this, they're actually controlled somewhat by accepted international practice and the laws of armed conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've got to make sure this thing is discriminate and precise.
Right.
The other people out there in the lower order of that spectrum, hacktivists and so on, mm-hmm. they're not only not compelled to think that way, they may actually see it an advantage to be imprecise.
Absolutely.
And be not just indifferent, but enthusiastic about collateral damage.
Seems like that happened on the march from Boston to Concord, where there was a different type of warfare being fought.
Yeah. Well, you know, you bring this up, but for someone with my background, you know, 4 decades in the American Armed Forces, all advantage is transient, all right? There are no permanent advantages on any battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a race to stay ahead. And if you're not moving, you're falling behind.
So what are the consequences of allegations, for instance, that our allies are involved in this? Does it put a target on their back? I mean, what happens in our
okay.
our
So let's take
policy.
Let's just take the articles and say and be indifferent as to whether they're true or not, all right?
Okay.
Let's just say they're out there. I see a couple of things happening. Number one, I mean, it's alleged in the article that the United States had a partner here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, whether it's true or false, other potential partners are looking at this and saying, you know, when the Americans come to us and say, let's do something just between the two of us, don't worry, we're going to keep it secret, you know it's a good idea, we'll be discreet, we know how to do this. Well, no, we don't. or it appears that we don't, based on the article. So, and actually, Senator Feinstein, the chairman of the Senate Intel Committee, that's the point that she's been hammering. You know, people need to trust us. People need to believe we can keep secrets. So that's one impact. But let me give you another darker one. Again, and we can be agnostic as to whether the article is true or false. My counterpart in Iran, my counterpart from my old job, is a guy named Qasem Soleimani. He's ruthless, and he's also very good at his job, and he has got the confidence of the supreme leader.
Mm.
Now, I'm making this up completely, Foster, okay? But
okay.
I can imagine a scenario in which he says, hey, Mr. Supreme Leader, I need to get some time on your calendar next Thursday. And, you know, Mr. Supreme Leader, based upon what the Americans appear to have done, I have the following options available. Do you see the scenario rolling out?
Yeah.
And in one way, prior to the New York Times article, when a lot of people suspected, but you didn't have this kind of, you know, formal accusation being laid out there, it may have been easier for the Iranians to, quote unquote, let it pass.
Yes, yeah.
And now that you've got it out there, true or not, the Iranians now, the supreme leader, Well, he doesn't want to look weak at home, does
Absolutely.
He?
Absolutely, yeah.
And so the article itself, again, true or false,
yeah, doesn't...
may be motivating, incentivizing, creating behaviors that could be really dangerous.
We're talking, by the way, with General retired General Michael V. Hayden, the former head of the CIA and also the National Security Agency. Thank you very much for joining us on this.
Oh, sure.
What are we, as the United States, what are we liable to be under attack for right now? I mean, if you, regardless of the allegations that are going about what we're doing, this has got to be something that's being played out. And I'm sure there's somebody in a security position for our government. We must have been making provisions for this to protect ourselves, haven't we, for a long time?
You would think so.
Oh, I don't want to
hear
that.
We would hope so, actually.
We all fervently hope so.
I mean, it's in about just about every science fiction movie, from Mission Impossible to whatever, where they've drawn out scenarios just like this.
Right.
And you would think that we'd be protecting ourselves. Someone has to be thinking about this.
Oh, no. Thinking, we got. But, okay, let me lay out what the dangers are and then why, frankly, we have been slow to need, all right?
Okay.
You got three layers of dangers. By far, the overwhelming number of cases are concentrated in the danger I would call espionage, all right?
Mm-hmm.
That's just stealing your data. And a lot of it's intellectual property, a lot of it's trade secrets. Some of these could be state secrets. Some of it could be your personal information. But fundamentally, they're just stealing your stuff. That's, frankly, where almost all of it is right now. Occasionally, you'll get a cyber weapon to try to attack someone else's cyber network. Estonia 2008, Georgia
yes.
2000,
yes.
Estonia 2007, Georgia 2008, cyber attack for cyber effect. Now, Stuxnet, somebody, cyber attack, physical effect. So that's the danger, and you'd think we'd all be worried just like the way you teed up the question. Holy smoke, what are we doing? Foster, I'll tell you, I give this speech in a longer form to fairly well-informed audiences, and after about 15 or 20 minutes, I'm making them all afraid of the smartphone in their coat pocket, all right?
who's got my camera turned on? Cal Carson, you had a question to hear a
right.
follow-up.
And I can create the belief, that this cyber thing, this is a zone of conflict.
Yeah.
And I can actually create the thought in an American audience, where the heck's my government?
Yeah.
Zone of conflict, I'm in danger, where's the government?
Yeah.
But then, Foster, as soon as I'm done, okay, and everyone gets up from the auditorium, they actually reach into their coat pocket. They pull out that phone, and they check their email, and what was a zone of conflict a few minutes ago is now a zone of their personal communication,
yeah.
And every stitch of their American political cultural being clicks in now and says, zone of personal communication? Government? No, I don't think so.
Yeah, we have a cultural war going on there. General, I'm sorry, we're running out of time here. I'd love to listen to you talk for hours. Thank you so much for sharing this time with us. General Michael V. Hayden, former director of CIA and NSA, glad to have you with us, and thank you so much for joining us here on the Internet Advisor. We'll be back in just a moment to continue our conversation with Richard Steenen, talking about our response. Thank you once again for joining us for, I think, a very special edition of the Internet Advisor. Hope we haven't scared you too much by what's been talked about here. It is kind of mind-boggling, the dimensions of the espionage that's going on out there. And as General Hayden averred this last conversation we had, there's now real physical damage being done. For instance, in the Natanz, you may have heard references to that, and that's the Iranian nuclear facility where, because of the Stuxnet virus, the centrifuges, which were processing the uranium, actually some of them destroyed themselves, burned out. There was physical damage done because of that intervention. And with us in studio today, helping us with this conversation, is Richard Steenen, who is a security Internet security expert, also an author who has written about cyber war and the cyber stiletto he co-authored. And Richard, again, thanks for being with us. I want to kind of move the conversation, and Cal, you were going to set the scene for us. Why don't you ask that question you asked during the break, because I think it'll bring us to this next level.
Well, the general alluded to the fact that, you know, there's a lot going on out there that the public is not aware of, and
right.
they should be concerned because there's a lot of vulnerabilities that are going on. But all that happens very clandestine when it's dealing with government and military and those sort of folks. So the public sector, or I should say the private sector that writes all the protection for this sort of thing, is kind of left out of the loop. So how does that all get together so that, you know, they can find out, but yet they don't know that they know what they know when they shouldn't know what they know.
Wow, and that's a perfect lead into Richard's article that he wrote in Forbes. Came up. It was called Operation Olympic Games, Project X, and the Assault on the IT Security Industry.
Yeah. So there's a couple aspects of this. And, Cal, you hit the sweet spot of discussions going on in D.C. and London. And they call it information sharing. And you've got all these agencies who probably have some really, really good idea about attackers, sources of attacks, and methodologies. They do not share it with the private sector. And you'll see that in a lot of legislation. They try and encourage this. It was part of the Comprehensive Cybersecurity Initiative, and yet very little actually happens. Even federal sharing with state and local government doesn't happen at the level that it should be.
Yeah, interagency is lousy. Oh, it's always been warfare.
Yeah, exactly. There's walls set up between them, and they do not cross them. And now we've got this issue of the government creating weaponized software, as we call it, and the security industry, including signatures for Stuxnet and Duco, they're all in there now, so you can't get infected by those. And systems are being patched. And you've got this very strange situation developing where people are defending themselves against weapons created, we think now, by the United States. And is that going to take the next step where, for instance, President Obama issued an executive order making it illegal to sell certain types of filtering technology to Syria because Syria is using...
That is one of the proposals, isn't it?
Well, they actually have an executive order. So now it's illegal to do this. The trouble is if you expand the definition of filtering, you're including all routers. Now what happens? And what happens if they start saying, hey, we're targeting Iran, so you can't sell them X, Y,
and
Z.
Essentially, you have this great irony out there. Eddie, you put your finger on it before. A Russian security agency, Kaspersky, was one of the ones that trapped some of these things first and began to talk about it. And then you also quoted in your article somebody from Mikko Haipanen, who's from F-Secure, the Finnish security agency. The quote is interesting. He said, Flame, which is one of these advanced persistent threats, Flame was a failure for the antivirus industry. We really should have been able to do better, but we didn't. We were out of our league in our very own game. So now they're starting to get their game on.
Yeah.
And we got a collision course going.
Well, this started years ago. I remember when I was at Gartner, Symantec came to me, or a big bank came to me, and they said, hey, we have this code, malware, that infected our systems. We gave it to Symantec. And this would be true for any antivirus vendor. And they said, well, that's not in the wild, in quotes, so we're not going to add it to our signature base. We're not going to write a signature for that one. That was, 5-10 years ago. Now, most viruses that infect people's computers only infect, 10 different computers. So the antivirus vendors have to write signatures for everything, and that could be 30,000 new signatures a day.
Well, if I remember right, back 5 years ago, most antivirus companies were trying to, instead of do signatures, they were doing, holistic scans where they were...
Heuristic.
Heuristic, where they were basically tracking what the software was doing, and if it was doing something that it shouldn't be doing, and then supposedly it would then trigger some alarms.
And F-Secure is actually one of the best at doing that. Though for the most part, it tends to there's false positives, and that's the worst thing, right? Yeah. Don't break something I've already.
So you're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't.
But now but Stuxnet, was really targeted at a nuclear reactor centrifuges. If we had used a traditional weapon or a nuclear weapon to take out that nuclear,
the refining capability.
There would have been fallout,
Literally.
So, is this a better way to fight wars?
But this is fallout, Gary. This is fallout.
Well, but I didn't get affected, and nobody around the planet
got... Not yet, maybe.
Actually, even Fermi, our nuclear power plant just down the coast from us here, did see a Stuxnet-like infection. So it was, it was post...
you mean the one here in Michigan?
Yeah.
Right down on the river.
Caused no damage, but they saw examples of the code. So it's
we're
spread
running
all over the
centrifuges
world.
Down a river?
No.
Just checking.
Not enriching radium.
But the point is, if they wanted to target it a different way, there would have been a lot more casualties.
Right.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And as the general said, the thing that when it's a state, if it is a state-sponsored things, there are conventions, the Geneva Conventions, et cetera. There's kind of general conventions. When that gets out into the wild, though, then you have the thing like the dirty bombs. People bring, they don't want to bring a whole nuclear bomb in. Just bring in some of the material and scatter it around and poison the water or whatever.
Well, I mean, how can you go by these conventions when Iran basically agreed not to develop nuclear refinement?
And absolutely.
And they're going against that. So, you know, they're sort of, yep. I mean.
Cal's got a grin on his face. This is going
to
be a good one.
This just tugs me right to the end. You know, like, who decides who gets what?
I know,
it's like all of a sudden, you know, it's like, we're going to run the whole game, and you can't have this, and you can't have this, and you can't have this. People are going to say, you know something, I'm an independent entity, I'm going to come up with it.
Yeah.
Now, whether it's good or not is another story, and that's a whole other discussion.
Yeah.
But the only thing you can do is, you know, you got the best offense is a good defense, in my opinion, and you just protect
and
yourself
that's what
the from the other people.
Now, Richard, I want to because we don't have that much time, I want to jump out. You are consulting, along with the general as well, in the private sector. What's going on in the private sector on this? Because as he pointed out, there are major oil refineries and, you know, major commercial, you know, manufacturing, et cetera, they're being hit by these things. What's happening there?
Well,
how are they defending themselves?
You talked about being scared. People in the private sector, when they witness what's going on and these targeted attacks, they get really scared. It is. I had an opportunity to talk to the CISO of EMC, which of course owns RSA, mm-hmm. and they had the most famous breach to date last March of 2011. And while they were watching the attack proceed, so they identified something strange. They start looking around. They found an advanced persistent attack. At one point, they discovered that it was coming from outside the U.S., so they stopped doing their forensic collection of data for a lawsuit later on. They just started digging in to track this down. And at about that point, they noticed that the attack accelerated in sophistication and speed as if the attackers brought in their A-team. And so at the other end of this internet connection, in which, you know, there's been testimony in Congress that attributes it to China, not from RSA, they haven't said that. The bad guys brought in their big guns.
The big guns. Mm-hmm. Wow. So there is a booming market for people like yourself taking this information that you have. And I guess, Cal, the thing is, because it is an open atmosphere, the security companies out there, the Kaspersky's and Symantec's, et cetera, and other wizards like yourself, are getting their heads together, and we're not completely in the Wild West atmosphere. Folks, we have only scratched the surface. Again, please go to internetadvisor.net. On our homepage, the two articles, the one from the New York Times, and then we also have the article in there that Richard wrote about this collision course between the security industry and governments on this level of wealth. Richard Steenan, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a pleasure, as always. And folks, if you want to listen to this again, it's worth it. Download it on our podcast or sign up on iTunes and get it delivered to you. We'll be back. Coming back, it's time for you and your questions at 800-859-0957. The Internet Advisor on the air for you. Thank you for joining us for hour number two of The Internet Advisor. We might have had some heady stuff in that first hour, but right now it comes down to your practical problems with computers and getting on the Internet, getting around it, sending pictures on email, whatever it may be, big or small. We'd love to take a crack at answering your question, but the only way we can do that is if you call us. 800-859-0957. 800-859-0957. Call us right now, and we'll get busy answering your question.
You're listening to a podcast of WJR's Internet Advisor. For help with any computer problem, call in during our live show or visit our webpage at internetadvisor.net.
No question too big or too small for us to tackle here on the Internet Advisor. Foster Brown, Gary Baker, Ed Rudell, and Cal Carson all in studio, and we're ready to handle your questions at 800-859-0957. Again, that's 800-859-0957. And while you're getting up the gumption to do that, and by the way, it's very simple, you don't have to be an expert to ask a question. It's just to have a question. And our mantra has been here all along is the only dumb question is the one you don't ask, because quite often your question can help answer a lot of other people's questions as well. So the phone lines are open, and this is going to be happening or not, depending on whether you give us a call at 800-859-0957. Before we get to our callers, Eric Anderson has gathered together a Mac Minute for us this week that'll talk about the upcoming Worldwide Developers Conference, the big show for Apple that will be going on starting on Monday of this coming week. And Eric, let's hear what your Mac Minute looks forward to in its crystal ball.
This week on the Mac Minute, a final roundup of WWDC rumors. The Worldwide Developers Conference begins next week with a keynote address from Apple executives. The rumor mill is up and running regarding what we could see announced. AppleInsider.com says we could see a brand new line of MacBooks with Retina displays, solid-state hard drives, and no optical drive included. Screen sizes would vary from 13 to 15 inches and cost between $11.99 and $17.99 depending on size. We're also expected to hear more about iOS 6 as well as macOS Mountain Lion. Photos of Apple banners hanging in the Moscone Center in San Francisco, where the event will be held, have already surfaced on the internet, confirming we'll definitely be hearing more about iOS 6. As usual, these are just rumors for now. More to come when the keynote address kicks off at WWDC on Monday. For the Internet Advisor, I'm Eric Anderson, and that's the Mac Minute, give or take a few seconds.
Thank you so much, Eric, and we will all be waiting attentively next week. At this time in our show next week, we'll have Eric on to talk about some of the things that have been finally uncovered. The mist will have cleared at the Apple headquarters in Cupertino. Right now, however, we are waiting to dispel the mists in your computer experience, and you can do that very simply by giving us a call at 800-859-0957 and making this hour happen. And we look for the callers coming in just a moment, 800-859-0957.
And yeah. You know, you talk about the mist clearing out in California at Cupertino. I was checking on one of the Apple websites that I follow, or one of the OS Daily websites, I should say, and one of them has posted some pictures from CNET, and it appears that iOS 6 is on its way because they're already putting up the banners at the Moscone Center for Monday's presentation. So it doesn't say specifically it's here, but it does say that they're going to talk about iOS 6.
It's a pretty poorly kept secret at that rate.
Well, you know, I saw a couple things that were interesting this last week, and that in AnnArbor.com, they report on a number of different things that are happening. There was a laptop stolen, and they reported that they found the thief right away because as soon as he turned it on, the webcam took his picture. And then it captured his keystrokes that he was bragging about he stole this laptop and he was going to sell it on the market and whatever. But the police knew who it was. The person that owned the computer had the photo uploaded to the cloud, brought it down, gave it to the police. Police said, yeah, we know this guy. They went over, picked him up, got the computer back. It's a piece of $40 software. Any of us can put it on our...
No kidding. Was this on a PC?
It was on a PC. So you could take and put it on its Orbical. It's like Orb, I-C-U-L-E, Orbical, and software. And for $40, you can take a picture of anybody that happens to steal your computer and log on.
One caveat, please don't get too excited out there, folks. Make sure that the laptop that you have has a camera built into it. Because if it doesn't, it's not going to do you much good. There's a lot of people who could have older laptops and say, hey, I got protection.
Yep. Anybody with a webcam.
Yeah, so you have to have a webcam with
that. Which is pretty much any laptop now since, 4 years ago, I think, probably.
They also offer businesses the option of having laptops without to cut the cost.
Oh, that okay.
You know, so my corporate laptop does not have one.
I'm impressed, Gary, though, that a police agency, maybe Ann Arbor's advance in this area as well, would bother to take this. Because often you hear people talk about, well, I went to a county sheriff or I went to whatever, and they said, look, we can't handle this. You know, we just don't
have it. Exactly. It's not worth our time.
It's not worth our time. I'm glad they did something.
Yeah, and apparently they knew the guy, so they knew where he lived, right? Otherwise, they just had a photo of the perpetrator. If they didn't know who it was, that would be a harder thing to do.
Or if it weren't for a few boneheaded thieves.
But you know what? There's more and more surveillance cameras out, you know, doing the same thing. We see that on the news where, here's the surveillance camera photo of whoever is causing the problem, right?
Right. Or the ATM across the street,
captures it.
Captures it.
Yep, absolutely. There's all sorts of ways that, technology can help. Just got to know about it. So just thought we'd brief some of
our listeners.
I'm
glad you said that because, you know, after the last hour, you kind of think, oh, I'm naked out here and it's a storm and there's nothing to protect me, you know, but there are ways that you do have a protection.
Better living through science.
Thank you for that.
I just love that from the 50s. I don't know why.
I know. Better living, by the way, for you if you have a computer problem, if you give us a call at 800-859-0957. I think everybody's got lemonade by the pool. But it's also a good time for you to pick up your cell phone and give us a call if you have a particular question. Ed, one came in from, described herself as a granny, but I think I love, she says she's a non-techie nana who sends email pictures. And she said, I finally had the courage to upload some pictures from my camera into my computer. I attempted to email a photo, but I got the following message. There's no email program associated to perform the requested action. Please install an email program, or if one is already installed, create an association in the default program control panel. So we give her a little help with that. Maybe when we come back after this break, we can talk about how you helped her with that particular question. But if you have one out there like Granny's, we'd love to hear from you at 800-859-0957. You heard the young lady. That's the magic number. And we will be getting to your calls as they're being lined up right now by Annie Nichols and Rich Lisinski, by the way, engineering behind there. Two important people to our program here. Thank you very much for your help. By the way, InternetAdvisor.net is the site for you to go for all sorts of information during the week as well. And by the way, we have a Facebook page. If you want to go there, friend us. And what I try to do now is to put all the information that we pick up during the week, interesting stories, et cetera, in there. And then on our homepage, InternetAdvisor.net, you'll see there's a couple of news stories there. I try to put information in there that has to do with the guests that we have on the air, particularly during our first hour, which is what we did today. So that's kind of the logic of it now. So if you are interested in some of the stories that we as a group of people are following, I am constantly putting stuff into that Facebook page, the Internet Advisor there. Just friend it and go in there, and you'll keep up with the kind of things that we're looking at. So like on security this week and some of the other things that we're looking at. Ed, before we went to the break, we were talking about Grandma Joyce, who was trying to send some pictures through the email to somebody and was having a terrible time getting the pictures on board to be able to send them.
And that's probably because they uploaded them to the cloud or whatever, and then usually when you want to click on a photo and upload it, well, Windows needs to know what your default email program is. Mm-hmm. And Windows needs to know a program name like Outlook Express or Windows Live Mail or regular Outlook or regular Microsoft Outlook or what's the other one? Eudora. And Firefox uses, starts with a J. But what do you do about web-based mail? You know, and there's not an easy way of doing that. Well, the simplest way is if you use Comcast and you use only webmail, Comcast will provide you with a toolbar. And that toolbar will then intercept when you click on mail this photo to, it'll intercept it and then it'll launch the website, which allows you to log into your mail server.
Okay.
So this lady happened to work for, or her email is SBC Global, which uses Yahoo Mail.
Mm-hmm.
So if she downloads the Yahoo toolbar, it'll allow her to click on those websites that allow her to say, mail this to, and it'll then launch her in an open window. She'll log into her webmail.
Okay.
And it'll pre-fill out the two addresses. And
so it takes care of all that for you. That's the key then.
Yep, is to get the toolbars.
Get the toolbars, and you can download them by going to whoever that web-based is.
Yep, whoever your ISP is or whoever your Gmail has one. Yahoo has one, Comcast.
Hotmail, I think, also has one.
Yes.
You know, they're pretty
general. Now, those are all applicable if you're using a web-based mail solution, correct?
Correct. Okay. I mean, but most of them do. I'm not sure. If you're... like Windows has the ability to select default mail programs, but it doesn't allow the ability to choose who's your default, internet-based mail program. It doesn't do that.
Yeah, the only one that wouldn't work like that would be like AOL or something like that, which has their own package with it. Is that correct?
Well, you can get the AOL toolbar.
Oh, great.
And do that. But so we all know what things, that leads to.
yeah. That leads to a lot of other stuff being tacked on there as well.
Yes, exactly.
That is one of the solutions then for being able to easily mail your photos off. All right, let's go to our phone lines. And again, our number is 800-859-0957. This is your part of the show, folks. So you give us a call, and we will tackle any question you got there. And let's welcome Catherine. Hi, Catherine. How are you doing? And welcome.
Hi. I'm doing great, and I love your show, and I think you guys are absolutely wonderful.
Thank you.
And I was driving to get to somewhere, and I heard you saying, you know, that we could call in, so I thought, I'm going to call.
Wonderful. Thank you.
I am not a techie, but I'm learning, and I love it. My husband hates it. I have a MacBook Pro that's going on 2 years old.
Okay.
And I've updated to Snow Leopard.
Okay.
But I purchased a new one so that he could have the old one because I travel with it and I need to have the insurance.
Way to go. Way to go, Mom. Give the old man the other one. Yeah, let him be the truck.
He loves it. Now, I have not learned Lion that well, and okay. It's much different. And when I wanted to go to iCloud, they advised me to put both machines on iCloud at the same time because it would be easier.
Okay.
But the problem is I don't want to change the other operating. I don't want to change Snow Leopard's Lion because I finally got my husband using it. He loves it. And I don't want to mess
okay.
that up.
So the question, I guess the question Catherine sounds like, and Cal, maybe you can sort this out as well, is it, how do you go to the iCloud folks, by the way, for most of you out there who don't use it, are not Mac users, is a web-based place that you can store things. It's also like a server that allows you to transfer your mail.
Yeah, and you don't have to be a Mac user to use iCloud.
I beg your pardon. You're right.
Because I use iCloud, and I don't have a Mac.
Okay, yep. I beg your pardon. But for Macs, it was initially that was the solution. Mm-hmm. But you're right. Now, it is agnostic and open in that sense. Yep. But she's asking questions, I guess, Cal. Can her husband stay on the old platform? It's Leopard, you said?
Snow Leopard.
Yes, Snow Leopard.
Snow Leopard, okay. Can he stay on Snow Leopard, and can she create iCloud accounts for both the machines, the new one running Lion and the old one running Snow Leopard?
I would probably create one separately on each.
Right.
In other words, all it needs is an Apple ID in order to create the iCloud account. So for her machine, she should create one account for that one. And then on his machine, he can get an Apple ID and create iCloud on his one as well.
I see. I have about five more questions.
Go ahead.
We're
feeling wild and crazy today.
I had to pull over to ask you these questions.
I'm glad you pulled over.
Well, I have a Mac account, which is now an ME account, which right. I keep getting notices that by July it's not going
to
be there
yes,
anymore.
Yes, you do need to migrate it, and it's pretty simple, Cal, right?
Yes.
It's a pretty simple effort. Go ahead.
So what do I do, though? I mean, I've got a website that's going to disappear, too. I'm trying to figure out what I'm going
to
do.
Two issues there, I think.
Now, here's the problem. On the website situation, you're going to have to find another place
to host that
website because there won't be anything available to you in iCloud for that website. So that is one of the good things about MobileMe that I'm sorry to see go away. So you'll have to download all the components of your website back down to your computer if you don't already have a copy there, and then rehost those components somewhere else on another location.
And, Cal, the good thing is that there are a lot of free website hosting facilities, right, where she could take and put that up, like, and if you just
WordPress,
Google for,
I think.
If you just Google for, free hosting, you'll be able to find a number of places. Some are easier than others.
I think Google offers it.
Google does. Remember,
GoDaddy?
GeoCities.
Oh, GeoCities.
GeoCities still
does.
And there's a number of them.
That's one aspect of it, okay? Now, Cal, how does she migrate, though? And this is a question for all Mac users out there who haven't done it yet. How do you go from your me.me or .mac account to the cloud, to the iCloud?
Well, the best way to do it is to go to the Apple.com website and look for a document, H as in Harry, T as in Tom, 4918. And that'll give you all the information on moving from MobileMe to iCloud. And it tells you how to prepare to do it, how to move your mail, your calendars. It tells you also what MobileMe aspects will be affected when you move to iCloud. Look at that document. It'll help you out really a whole lot.
H as in Harry, T as in Tom, 4918. So that'll give you, Catherine, without going into more details, that'll give you a place to look for it.
Yeah, that's in their knowledge base.
Okay.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
One more question before we're getting close to having to take a little break here. Go ahead.
No, I think that's it.
Oh, my goodness.
Because it was the website and the ME were the two separate questions, but you kind of did them both at once.
Good.
So
you understand that both you and your husband can have access to the iCloud, but you have to set it up with different Apple IDs. Yeah,
should do that, mm-hmm. right? Don't have
yes.
to.
Yeah, well, I think he'd rather not, so I think I'll just have mine.
Once he sees yours, he'll like it.
He's going to be so jealous when he sees you rocking it.
I don't think so. He's just happy to get off the PC and onto the Mac right now.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what made you make that transformation? Because it's still a relatively small group of people who are doing that. And percentage-wise.
From the PC?
Yeah.
We were ready to throw it out the window. It was terrible. It was a desktop. It was about 5 years old.
Okay. So yeah, you moved up to a whole brand new experience. Catherine, thank you so much for your call.
Okay,
it's been a delight talking
to you.
Have a wonderful day, and now you can get back on the road again. And for the rest of you out there, get off the road and give us a call at 800-859-0957. Again, that's 800-859-0957.
Great question. We like those kind of questions.
Excellent. Looking for your question when we return. Thanks so much for joining us here on the Internet Advisor. By the way, might give you a little peek around the corner here next week. Emily Hay is going to be in studio with us with her Hay There Social Media monthly contribution. And Gary's got a couple of guests as well. We'll be talking about social media and bringing technology to the jungle. So that should be a lot of fun coming up this coming week.
That's
so,
right. Yeah, we're
so
going to
Emily will bring a Hay Day.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
She brings a lot of class whenever she comes
certainly
in.
Does. Certainly class does. Classes this place up for sure.
All right, we've got our three guys in here today. Lots of testosterone working around the studios. Let's get this going, guys. Get some work. Mike from Royal Oak, thank you so much for joining us here on the Internet Advisor. You're looking for some advice on backing up programs?
Yes, yeah, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You guys have helped me out before.
Good, glad to have done that.
Yeah, I run a small company, and we network our computers, and over many years, we've had hard drives crash on us, and we back up the data. We normally partition the hard drives and put the data on the D drive of the server or servers, and that's fine. That's not a problem. But if a hard drive crashes, especially if it's a server, we've got a lot of programs on there, and it takes us a long time we have to reinstall everything. I guess there's no shortcuts to that. And the last time it happened, we went to a computer guy, and we said, how can we avoid this? And we talked about RAID, but you've got to have identical drives, and they got to be all
right.
put in place at the same time, I
right.
guess. So it's too late for that. So I was looking around on the internet the other day, and I saw a product from Western Digital, and it's called a 4 terabyte Sentinel. DX4000,
mm-hmm.
And it's billed as a small office storage server, and so I'm guessing that's geared to storing data and not programs. But could we use something like that to actually install our programs on? And it's got RAID built in. It's got multiple drives already built in. It's
mm-hmm.
it's taken all the headaches out of admin, I guess.
Yeah.
Would that be something that we could we install programs on something like that?
Here's the issue with doing programs, okay? When you're given a license for a program, it's either licensed by individual or it's licensed by a site.
Per seat, you mean? Like
by seats instead, sort of thing. So what would happen is that your licensing for the software that you probably have is individual as opposed to as a full enterprise that you have there. So you'd have to change your licensing so that people would be able to execute the programs off the server as opposed to doing them independently
to
the machine.
Is that what they call thin client? The individual...
At the individual client
side, the individual, they become dumb terminals then.
It becomes more virtual desktop.
Right, exactly.
Thin client.
So do you understand that, Mike, that option we're talking about?
Well, the licensing part, I do, and I think we got it covered. Most of the programs we're using are network licensed, programs.
Okay.
Then
so I think what
there.
You're trying to say is that you're saying if my server takes a crash, how do I get it back up and going as fast as possible, correct?
Correct.
Okay. My first thought would be you'll probably want to do something like when you build that server and you put all your programs and stuff on it, prior to you putting the data on that server,
you would take and do an image snapshot of that server as it was standing at that particular place, and you would create an image file for it using a product, maybe like a Cronus.
Exactly.
And then once you create that image file, you would store that on a separate drive somewhere.
Or CDs.
Or safely.
Or on a CD or whatever, but somewhere separate.
A removable drive you could put in a safe deposit box, for instance.
Exactly. And then what would happen is that if your server took a crash again, you would get that drive back, you'd boot the server back up, use the Acronis software to read that image back into the server, and it would put the server back to the point it was when you took that image. At that point, then, if that image was like 2 years ago, you would apply all the appropriate software patches and updates to the operating system to it, bring back your data, and then you'd be back up and running. But seriously, if you have the type of situation, I think, where you need more reliability to your servers, thinking about doing RAID might just be a thing you want to consider, because you can lose hard drives in a RAID array and still continue to work.
Yeah, but doesn't the Western Digital is basically a network addressable storage? It's a NAS server.
Oh, yes.
So, and it's basically, its only function is to offer a drive letter to everyone. And so if you could, install apps onto it and data, but what you want is something that has RAID capability. So if you could find a NAS, network addressable storage.
NAS.
That, and I'm not sure if the Western Digital Sentinel offers that. If you could find something that you just pop in there and it's just network storage, you can install your apps on and your data, and it also offers RAIDs, that's the way to go.
Well, then if he was going to go that route, then the choice, in my opinion, would be a Drobo. Drobo is definitely machine that can do that type of situation, and they come in all different levels and prices.
You can put different size drives in there, too, am
I
right?
Yeah, the Drobo is really cool because you can mix drive sizes in it, so you don't have to go out and buy a whole bunch of 2-terabyte drives all at the same time. You could use some of the existing drives you have now and build it as it goes along, but it also has RAID redundancy built into it as well.
So have you heard that before, Mike? It's called Drobo, D-R-O-B-O.
Yes, I have. Yeah, and I saw a couple of them, they're like drive enclosures, and you just pop in your own hard drives.
Yes, so the benefit there is you can use existing drives. You can also expand if you want, then, bigger and bigger drives.
Right, it comes with RAID capability, and that's what's important.
Would you explain RAID for people who are listening right now, just so we're not, off in science
fiction? Well, RAID is an acronym that stands for Redundant Array of Inexpensive Drives.
I love it.
And basically what it does is, rather than write data all on one drive, it takes a group of drives and writes the data across all the drives, let's say five drives. And then what happens is, because it's striped and the data is redundant, if you pull one drive out of the array or it fails, the other drives know how to build that data back together and continue to work.
So, Mike, do you see the advantage of that?
I do, yes. And we were tempted to do it on the we haven't built a server since that last problem, but the guy said we'd have... In order to do that, you've got to do it all up front, and he told us we have to have two identical drives, same brand, same size, same everything.
Yeah, but you probably don't even need...
Typically, you do, and that's why Drobo is interesting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. But it sounds like you don't even need servers right now. And, I mean, you're probably thinking of, you used to have a Windows 2000 or a Windows 2008 server, or maybe even a Linux server, and that crashed on you. If you get a NAS server or a Drobo, it's just network storage. That's it. There's no server. There's no operating system. Everyone just accesses it as a network drive, and printers are independent of it as well.
Now, here's another thing for you to consider, and I'm sure Gary, being more an enterprise sort of person, can give a better answer for this if I'm getting this wrong. Figure out how long it takes to get that machine back up and running if you didn't have RAID, and the amount of time that you would save if you did have RAID, and how much that's going to cost you business-wise, and then that will justify whether or not you need to consider going to a RAID system.
And another thing you might want to consider is cloud-based storage. There's a lot of companies in the area that are offering these to small companies.
Online Tech, Gary,
including Online Tech, who does our website, and Gary has a close relationship with them, and they'll offer cloud-based internet storage backup, and of course they're redundant, so your data is actually stored in the cloud somewhere.
May be at the place, Mike, where you need to think of that as like a next step.
Yeah,
I've heard about the cloud stuff. it being a small guy, you know, it makes me a little nervous storing data. We got client information and everything. It makes me nervous storing.
Gary, why don't you talk to that a little bit?
Well, you know, obviously you got to pick the right hosting firm to do that. But there are some big firms that go to the cloud today. You know, it really helps. You know, most of us in years past used to use Iron Mountain or somebody like that to come pick up tapes and store them off-site because you didn't want something to happen to your data center and have all of your tapes sitting right there next to it, you know, or in the case of RAID where you have your redundancy right there in the same box. You know, today, if you can go to the cloud to do off-site, you bypass the guy that comes around in the little green truck and picks up your tapes. So it's a much cheaper way of doing what we all used to do with tapes and much more secure.
Because the data is encrypted at your site and it's encrypted when it arrives at the the cloud location, wherever it is.
And these cloud locations, like the bunker that they've got their stuff in for online technologies, is incredible. Go ahead, Cal.
I think the best thing of all is that you probably are at a point in your business right now where you need to spend a few bucks on a good consultant to come in and sit down and look at exactly what you need to be able to protect yourself and your business, and that would be money well spent.
So we've done a little of that for you right now, Mike, and essentially what you need to do is to get somebody to sit down with you and do it a little more step-by-step way. But I hope we've opened a little something up for you, okay?
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Mike. And by the way, we took a little time with that because I know there are people out there who have businesses. And thank you for that. Hey, Alex in East Point, we're coming to you. And also, we've got lines open for you as well at 800-859-0957. Now, a lot of people make this program go around. I'd like to thank again to Annie Nichols, who is our screener there, along with Rich Lisinski, who's behind the board of as our engineers, along with our crew here inside the studios, Gary, Ed, and Cal. We have the full team here. So let's, guys, dive right back in and say hello to Alex from East Point. Alex, you have a concern about Windows and an auto-run infection with a USB drive?
Yes, I don't have one, but this relates to your first hour discussion. And something I think I remember from your show previously, I'm a longtime listener, love your show. And previously you mentioned, I think I heard something about an autorun file on a USB drive.
That
would get run and basically start something executing as soon as the drive is inserted.
Yeah, matter of fact, I think Ed was one of the ones that brought that up, and Ed and Cal talked about that. Go ahead,
yes. And my question would be, is there any way for a Windows computer to be possible to be infected with when a USB drive is inserted if that USB drive does not have an auto run file on it? Can there be something buried in there that doesn't look like a file? Or
good question.
Essentially, that would mean if there is a auto run file and it's deleted, does that make that drive then safe? This would be like an application
good.
Where...
Two questions really you're asking there, I think, is, you know, if you pull that auto-run function out of the USB stick, then am I safe, or is there something else that could be on there that could execute without my knowing about it? Those are two things?
Right, yes. And this would be my application would be, say I'm at the library looking up some product information on the Internet and I want to bring it home on a USB drive at my leisure. I want to make sure there's no way I can bring something home to my own computer. And I want to know is that... auto-run file.
Okay, those are good questions. As a matter of fact, it's almost like the Stuxnet thing that we were talking about where we figured that somebody took a drive and did that. What do you think, Ed?
Well, first about going to the library. Libraries that I go to, they re-image their computers every night.
And then
they update the antivirus. It's always possible that if their computer becomes infected, that... if you're copying data to an external flash drive, that it could copy an infection on there or a virus. So I have no control over that. It's always a possibility. Now, as far as the auto run, I'm not sure if Microsoft looks for any other file type other than autorun.inf. That's a great question I'll have to ask. I do know that what I do is whenever I put a flash drive in, I always hold down the shift key. And that disables autorun functionality. So you hold the shift key down, and it disables the CD-ROM.
That was my second question, is what's the refresher on how to not run that autorun file. Is that shift key for all versions of Windows?
As far as I know, it goes back to 98.
Yeah, I think it is.
And, my old computer runs that.
And then the whole idea is then you can scan it, right?
Yeah.
Before you start to use it.
Yeah. So you can would run your antivirus on it.
Right.
Yeah. Or at least get that file out of there. So so if I have a USB drive, press shift key on insertion, look at the contents, if there's no autorun, and if there's no other method besides autorun, it should be safe.
Oh, as you said, you could scan it with whatever your software
has. Well, if you're going to put a foreign USB drive in your computer, then you would hold the shift key down, and it would prevent it from auto-starting. Or a friend, say, hey, can you give me those photos so I could, show my daughter? And then you would, when you put their USB flash drive in your computer, in your PC computer, not a Mac, you hold the shift key down.
Okay, shift key for Windows.
Yep, and now there's a Microsoft article, and they do this in a lot of corporations for the same reason. They disable all auto-run features. And Microsoft has an article on that. It's 967715, and it talks about how to disable auto-run on Windows using either group policy or you're modifying the registry or using some of the control panel and disable
auto-run. So you don't have to remember in that case to hold down the shift.
Right, like say I want to put a DVD movie in my laptop, and I'm about ready to go to the airport because I know I want to watch that 4-hour movie, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But I don't want it to play when I pop it in there, right? So you hold the shift key down, it prevents the movie from starting as well.
I got you.
So yeah, I guess that's a possibility that another way that a virus could get onto your computer is that it's also scanning for video files, like if it has an audio or a video _TS.
Oh yeah,
like which is on a DVD, it will attempt to autoplay it, and viruses can be passed through media files. Yeah, as
exactly
well.
Right, and image files. I'm understanding too.
So CDs and DVDs could be the same thing then.
Yes. Right. So the key seems to two steps here. First of all, you stop the auto run, but then you want to, if this is a drive that you're not sure, or you've been somewhere else and you're bringing information in, then you want to scan that with your antivirus.
Okay.
That's a way of handling that. All right?
Okay. Super. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alex. You've asked a great question, an excellent question. Let's go to Hank, who's from Mount Clemens. Hank, how you doing? And thank you very much for joining us. So you are looking for some good books for beginners, huh?
Right.
How much do you know about computers?
Well, I'm all the way up to pulling in, buying and selling on the Internet.
Oh, good. Okay, so you're doing some buying and selling. Yeah, you've moved on.
but now what I want to know is moving one thing from one file to another file, and I seem to run into a roadblock.
Now, what are you trying to move from where to where?
Well, in other words, when I put the pictures out on the Internet, I put them out, but I don't put them in the proper category to sell. In other words, if I have a machine, I put it on electronics.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
To do with electronics, so I want to be able to set up a folder so that when I put something under industrial, it goes to that folder.
I understand. You want to collect things that you're selling on the Internet in a way on your computer that they're organized?
Right.
Okay, guys, and I know this is basic, but it's great you asked the question because there are people out there who have the same kind of concern. How do I organize stuff on my computer? Now, you're running a Windows PC, I'm going to guess?
I'm running Windows, yes.
What version?
On a laptop.
On what version? Windows 7?
Windows, yeah.
Excellent. Good for you. You're not bashful about technology. So, guys, basics on setting up a folder for somebody to collect things in.
Well, I guess the first question, are you trying to organize it on your computer or organize it on the Internet?
No, organize it on my computer so when I go on the Internet with it, I know which one to
get
the information.
Excellent.
Well, just by default, automatically, I would take all my pictures that I was going to use and I would put them into the pictures folder under my ID on that particular computer. Then after that, if I wanted to separate them out by categories, in that pictures folder, I'd make a right mouse click, and then I'd create a new folder and say, these are all my pictures of my tennis rackets, and put those in there, and then just move them over there. And then I make another folder, and these are all my pictures of my cars, and I'd move them over there. And that's the way I would organize them on
One of the big problems with computers, they're lovely for gathering data, but is sorting the darn stuff
and getting
control over it. Now, my wife's computer is a nightmare for that. We have pictures from everything. And part of the solution is that wonderful right click with your mouse. Now, you know what I'm talking about when I say right click, right, Hank?
Right.
When you right click, it gives you a little drop down menu that says create a folder. And then you would create a folder and you can name it what you want and then start collecting things there and gathering them.
Now, the other thing that I would do, though, too, is that if you want to go a step further, I'd get something like Photoshop Elements would be a good choice for using on a computer. It's a relatively inexpensive product, but the cool thing about it is that it brings up an interface, and on the pictures that you have, there's something called metadata. This is information that's buried in the picture that you don't see, time that you took the picture and where it's at. You can use that for sorting all your
pictures. Lots of different things out there to help you. But Hank, you asked a great question. Thank you for asking that question. You can also, if you want, give us an email at internetadvisor.net, and we'll see if we can help you a little further, okay?
Very good.
Thank you, and you're a brave soul to have ventured into the computer world that way with a laptop with Windows 7. Good for you. Guys, thank you so much for being with us this week.
It was fun, as always.
As always, Ed, thanks for being here, and Cal as well. It's been a delight being with you on the Internet Advisor. My name is Foster Brown, and by the way, don't forget that internetadvisor.net is your one-stop shop for all the information you've heard about here. Check our podcast out. It comes out usually by a couple days after we've been on the air with our live program. By the way, look for announcements of local in Detroit area, Michigan area computer organizations like the Southeast Michigan Computer Organization meetings and the Mac Group meetings. We'll publish them on our webpage as well. Thank you so much for being here. See you again soon.
You've been listening to a podcast of WJR's Internet Advisor. To hear previous podcasts, visit our webpage at internetadvisor.net.